This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at REACH 2015, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders on March 19 and 20, 2015.
Well, good afternoon. I don't know all of you, but I recognize quite a few faces here. And there are a few of you in this room who know something about working in a nonprofit organization. Some of the best and longest lasting lessons are lessons that you learned the hard way. You did something the way you thought it ought to be done, and then in hindsight you could look back later and you can understand some of the reasons why it didn't work the way you thought it should have, and maybe why it didn't endure. The topic they've given for today's workshop is building sustainable ministry infrastructure. And I'm going to really look at two of those words. I was talking to Eldon Hostetler yesterday, and he has a workshop that is actually entitled, the title wasn't that far off of this title. And we were just kind of curious about each other. What are you saying in yours? And what am I saying in mine? And we weren't going in the same place. And very easily could have had a lot of overlap there. What do you think of sustainable ministry infrastructure? Well, there's the first word that I took to operation. Able to be maintained at a certain rate or level, able to be upheld or defended, and then that big word, infrastructure. It was very interesting to me. Tuesday, as I was driving up toward Lancaster County, I was listening to a news program, and I heard the word infrastructure, and it was just sort of background noise in the vehicle. You know, the news is, I'm listening to the news and the word infrastructure. Okay, well, I'm talking about infrastructure. So I turned it up a little bit. I paid attention to what they were saying. And they used that word repeatedly in a story. And they were talking about, it was actually some sort of a news program here locally in Pennsylvania. And it was the head of your PennDOT, Pennsylvania Department of Transportation. And there was a question being asked to, I took it was a lady, is the head of that department, being asked to her about why are your potholes worse than they are in New York and et cetera, et cetera. And she had a big long answer. Till she was done, it sounded pretty good. So, okay, sure enough, that's why they got potholes here, and these potholes are better than the other potholes in other states. And there's a reason for all of this. Sustainable, what's infrastructure? The structure needed for the operation of a society or enterprise, or the services and facilities needed for the operation of an economy, generally defined as the set of interconnected elements that provide a framework supporting the entire structure of development. And here you can see I highlighted a few words that stood out to me. I see the word set there. Okay, when you have a set of something, it's not just one piece, it's a number of pieces. And it says that that set is made up of interconnected elements. And there I kind of think of, my mind goes to like a fishing net. And you know how it's made of string, and then there are knots tied. And if you pull on one part, all of the other parts end up moving a little bit, because they are not independent pieces. When my boys were little, we had a very large collection of wooden blocks. Their papa had a wood shop, and out of the scraps in the wood shop, we would go out and make blocks for the boys. So we had this huge bin of wooden blocks of all different sizes. And in the living room, we would create immense structures, buildings. And then the fun part was when it was all done and every last block was used and this monstrosity was built that was maybe this tall and from there to there and about this wide, you'd reach underneath and you'd pull one out. And then you'd pull another one out. And you were just waiting for the whole thing to fall down. And eventually it would fall down when you pulled enough out. But if these pieces are interconnected, you can't just pull one out and nothing happens. It does have an effect on the others. This set of interconnected elements, it provides a framework that something else is sitting on top of yet. So it's like we built this structure, and on top of it, now Mama came along and she put her plants up there, or a set of dishes. So this framework is supporting something else. All of a sudden, this is becoming more and more important. What is it supporting? It's supporting the entire structure of development, forward progress in this project or this organization. This word infrastructure, just like on the radio show, the lady from PennDOT, she was talking in civil terms, civil society, the thing that makes life work on a practical day-to-day level. That's where the word infrastructure is probably most commonly used. Infrastructure enables the operation of society. So what makes your life work in very practical ways? The conduct of business, the enjoyment of life itself. Well, it's the roads, it's the bridges. It's the place that pumps the water so that when you turn the faucet, water comes out. Well, that water came from somewhere. So when I wash my hands in the restroom just a few moments ago, and I turned that faucet, water came out. I did not for a moment think about where did that water come from? And that it came out of a pipe, but where did the pipe go? And who put that pipe there? And who designed that water system? And who keeps it running the way it should? And then when I wash my hands and the water went through my fingers, where did it go? It went down a drain. It didn't go down on the floor and get my socks and my shoes wet. It went down a drain that somebody designed and went down a pipe. And where do things go when they go down the pipe? They go away, okay? And that's about as much as we want to know about it. But there are people who took an interest in making sure that that water got away. And that actually becomes pretty important. If you take away or damage infrastructure, then the delivery of services is going to suffer or fail. Infrastructure is what you walk by all the time in your place of business, or when you go in town, or when you're in your own home. You're walking by infrastructure. You're not noticing it. But if it would ever go away, or if it's not functioning the way it should, for sure you would start to notice it. In civil terms, many of you came here on a road. And that road is a piece of infrastructure. And we might, you know, when I'm listening to this lady talk about why the potholes in Pennsylvania really aren't so bad, my first impression is, come on, get real. You guys standing alongside the road with a shovel, why don't you fix a hole so I don't get this jarring in my car? But then my second thought is, well, I've been to Haiti, and thank God for the roads that we have. I'm thankful for infrastructure that we have. I start noticing some things. You think about a picture like that there, that is an exchange on an interstate. I have never been on that particular interstate as far as I know, but I've spent a lot of time on interstates like you have. And I never spent much time thinking about the work that went into planning an interstate like that. You think about this particular picture. There is either an exit or an entrance ramp onto the interstate. And maybe it's both exit and entrance. But it rises from the ground at a certain rate of rise. It joins back in at a certain rate of fall. It has a certain curvature toward it, to it. It has support pillars underneath here that are bearing the weight. And by and large in this country, you don't on a daily basis hear about interstate bridges collapsing under the weight of the traffic that's on them. Because a lot of planning and investment has gone into infrastructure. And then even beyond that, there's other infrastructure in this picture. Do you see any infrastructure in this picture? If you subtract out the roads, do you notice there are some poles here? And I'm assuming that's a light pole. The picture is just a titch fuzzy, but that's a light pole. Where's the light come from? Juice? Where's the juice? What's in the wires? Well, where are the wires? I don't see any wires. Well, they're going down, and then they're down here somewhere. And where do they go? And how do you make sure that nobody, when they made the bridge, made it impossible to run a wire underneath that bridge? Okay? I have friends who are contractors. And when they build a house, my mind can't wrap around the complexity of thinking ahead that we're going to have to run a wire through here. And we better run that wire through here right now, because right now it's easy and cheap to run this wire. And if we wait till the house is done and you decide you want a receptacle over here or a light right here after the house is finished, it's either going to be very difficult to get that wire over there, we're going to have to destroy a lot of things, or it's going to become expensive. But if we do it right in the planning stage, it costs almost nothing to run that wire over there. That's infrastructure. Civil infrastructure is part of everyday life. Think about military infrastructure. The military is very concerned about infrastructure. It enables the deployment and the operation of fighting formations. When we think about the military, we think about the soldier carrying a rifle or driving a vehicle. When the military thinks about a soldier deploying, they're thinking about logistics. How do we get him there? Once he is there, how do we get him bullets and water and toilet paper and an internet connection? How do we deploy? And it's the buildings, and it's the systems, and it's the staff that make it possible. Effective long-range planning, in military terms, involves degrading an enemy's infrastructure so the enemy's armed forces cease to be effective and become easier to defeat. I'm going to tell you three little stories, and these little stories help me understand the value of infrastructure. All three stories come from the Second World War. In World War II, the United States military, beginning in 1940, developed strategies for combating the two primary enemies that the United States fought in World War II, which was Germany and Japan. And different strategies for different parts of the world and different enemies. But in both, the military strategy involved focusing on enemy infrastructure. Japan was a very powerful and technologically advanced country, and you just think about Pearl Harbor and the destruction that they inflicted on the U.S. military, one of the most humiliating defeats in American military history. Okay, so they're not a pushover. And how are we going to fight the Japanese? We are not going to beat the Japanese in 1940. If anybody gets beat in 1940 or 1941, they beat us. But we, I'm speaking as in terms of the U.S. military, we're determined to beat them, and we're going to beat them. Actually, the target was 1946. It will take until 1946, but we are going to beat them in the end, and it's inevitable, because we are going to take down their infrastructure. Japan was a maritime power, okay, stretching across oceans. And U.S. military strategy was that we are going to focus on two things. We are going to sink tanker ships. And that was the prioritized target for U.S. submarines. Of all your targets, if you see a tanker ship, you leave everything else, go, and you sink the tanker ship that's carrying oil, or it's carrying aviation gas, or it's carrying diesel fuel. You sink tanker ships. And then in the bombing campaigns, one of the highest priorities was refineries, where gasoline is being refined into diesel fuel, into lubricating oils, and into gasoline. We're going to focus when we're attacking Japan. For 4 years, we're focusing on taking down their oil infrastructure. In fighting against Germany, we're going to attack infrastructure. Germany is a continental power, a land power, and when we attack Germany, we are going to focus on their limited refining capacity, which was down in Romania, and we're going to focus on factories where armaments are produced. We're going to focus on railroads, bombing the railroads, and we're going to focus on railroad bridges and river bridges, road bridges. We're going to degrade infrastructure. On the German side of the war, the United States invaded France in 1944, June of 1944, the Normandy invasion. And the German army, although it had been fighting against the Russians for a number of years, was still a very powerful force. And there was a concern. There was concern about a certain armored division, the Das Reich Armored Division, that it would move and intervene at the Normandy landings. It was stationed in the southern part of France, coordinating with the French Free Forces, the local French resistance. They targeted infrastructure in France. They blew up bridges. They bombed and mined railroad tracks. And they had a plan that when the Normandy invasion starts, roadblocks are going to rise on certain roads overnight. The materials have been stockpiled by resistance fighters, and overnight we're going to block the roads from southern France to the Normandy beaches. It took the Das Reich Armored Division 15 days to get to the Normandy invasion. When it arrived, it was too late to intervene. Not because it was too difficult to defeat the Tiger II tanks that the Das Reich Armored Division drove north, but because they simply couldn't get there because the bridges were destroyed, the roads were bombed, and every time they came around a corner, there's another barricade on the road that, yes, you can push it off the road, but it takes a half hour to push it off the road, and you go a half mile up the road, and there's another one. And every half mile, every mile, you're pushing debris off the road. Infrastructure. They took down the infrastructure, and they didn't have to defeat the Das Reich Armored Division because it got there too late. How did that play out fighting the Japanese? 1944 also, the United States was coming back across the Pacific Ocean after having been driven across, had moved to retake the Philippine Islands, which was kind of a linchpin to the Japanese defense. And the Japanese knew that if they lost the Philippines, they then lost a critical piece of infrastructure, because on the Philippine Islands were airstrips, and you need airstrips to fly what? Airplanes. If you take away the airstrips, what happens to the airplanes? Okay, we need the Philippines, they need the Philippines, they lose the Philippines, their home islands, the Japanese home islands, are in the bombing range of American bombers. They couldn't afford to lose the Philippines, so they threw everything they had into the counterattack when the United States landed at Leyte Gulf in the Philippines. The counterattack failed disastrously. It failed disastrously because the United States had for 4 years attacked Japanese infrastructure. What's the value of focusing on destroying tanker ships and refineries? Why not attack airfields and troop concentrations and military headquarters instead? by attacking tankers and refineries, they guaranteed victory in the long term. When they fought the Battle of Leyte Gulf and what became known as the Marianas Turkey Shoot to the north, Japanese planes fell one after another from the sky. Because they had planes, they didn't have fuel for training. The experienced pilots that fought and successfully carried out the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1940, they're long dead by 1944, 4 years of war. They had 4 years to train a replacement generation of pilots. They had willing pilots. They had kept a core of competent instructors. But you know what they didn't have? They didn't have aviation gasoline. They didn't have fuel for the planes. Because the Americans were sinking the tankers and bombing the refineries, we run out of aviation gas, and it's in such short supply, the only thing we can teach the new pilots to do is take off and get the plane back down again. We can't teach them to dogfight because that takes up a lot of fuel, and we don't have gasoline to spare. We can't teach them to evasively maneuver when they're being pursued. We can teach them to take off, and we can teach them to land. Okay? They had the pilots and they had the planes, but they didn't have fuel. And that ended up being decisive. Also, when the United States had taken the Philippines, the next step was the island of Okinawa. And Okinawa was closer yet to the Japanese homeland, provided more airstrips for flying heavy bombers over Japan, considered vital to both sides. The Japanese threw in the last that they had as far as offensive capacity. For years, they had husbanded what was left of their fleet. And maybe if you've read the news, just in about the past 2 weeks, there was a news story that the wreck of a certain warship was found in the Pacific. It was the Musashi. And my illustration here about Yamato. Yamato was the sister ship. Two battleships that were built, the same series or the same model, you might say. Yamato and then Musashi, they were the biggest battleships ever built in the history of the world. The United States never built a battleship as big as Yamato. Displaced 72,000 tons. A crew of 2,000 men to operate one ship. Had three turrets, three guns to a turret, and the gun barrels were 18 inches in diameter. Okay, you think about the shell that an 18-inch in diameter barrel throws. The United States never fought either the Musashi or the Yamato in a fair fight. The Musashi was sunk at the Battle of the Philippine Sea by American airplanes because there were no Japanese airplanes to fly air defense over top of it. Remember, we don't have gasoline for training. So the fighter planes that were supposed to be flying over the Musashi to keep the American bombers away, they were shot down before they got there. So there was no air defense, and it was bombed to the bottom of the sea. The Yamato, it was sent with the last major groups of warships to go to Okinawa to repel the Americans. There was so little fuel oil left in the Japanese reserves that at the main Japanese naval base, they went into the tanks with buckets and were skimming across the bottom of the tank to get out the oil, the fuel oil, for the mightiest battleship ever built in the world. With buckets, they scraped up enough fuel oil for a one-way trip. We can get Yamato to Okinawa one way. There's no fuel for maneuvering to avoid bombing. Get to Okinawa, run it up on the beach, and beach it. And then use the guns from the beach. It never made it. It had no air cover, and it was bombed to the bottom of the sea. Okay? Why was Japan defeated in World War II? Oil. They had oil available, but they could not get it to Japan because the infrastructure was taken down. Infrastructure really does matter. Your ministries, what is the infrastructure that makes your ministries work? I'm going to give you a little bit of time to think here. This one is so obvious that if you didn't have it on the top of the list, you don't belong in the room, okay? But you'd all get this one, so I'm going to give you this one right here. What is it that you walk by it every day in whatever ministry you're involved in, and it makes your ministry work? If we would take this away, or we would degrade this, lower its capacity, you would start noticing the result. The greatest part of our infrastructure are human. I'm talking about secretaries and bookkeepers and administrators and custodians and project managers and maintenance men and people who do public relations work and graphic designers and accountants and board members and drivers. Okay, that's the greatest part. You just, from where you're sitting, just kind of turn around in groups of about three or four or five, and I want you to make a little list of everything else in the ministries that you're involved in that's infrastructure. It's that kind of stuff that's buried below the ground. You know, it's not the flashiest stuff in the world, but it actually makes your ministry work. And if I could take this away from your ministry, you stop working. Whatever you do, you stop doing. What is your infrastructure? So you talk to each other for a few minutes here. Okay, good enough. I just want you to just rattle off for us what's infrastructure where you live and work in terms of ministry. What's infrastructure other than people? Phones.
Software.
Marketing.
Postal system. Buildings.
Languages. Mm-hmm.
Systems.
Processes. This is the way we do things because this makes it work. Mm-hmm. Okay. Got a question for you. I used some military examples of a country, and it was our own country, being wise enough in the ways of the world to know that if it comes down to victory or defeat in 1940, we're the ones who lose. But we're going to invest 4 years attacking infrastructure before we really go for the throat. Spend 4 years of doing the unfancy things of bombing bridges, sinking ships, strangling them little by little. And then in about 1944, 1945, in Japan, they were thinking 1946, we'll reach over and squeeze their throat. But we're going to take them down for 4 years by degrading their infrastructure. If the world is wise enough to know to do that, do you think Satan is wise enough to look at your ministry and then consider that maybe a frontal attack isn't the best way to deal with this threat? There are things that these people aren't caring about enough, and I will go after their infrastructure. And in the long run, I will achieve more by attacking their infrastructure that they're not caring enough about defending. And then when it's time to go for the throat, I'll go for the throat in a time of my own choosing. But I'm going to degrade infrastructure. I told you that I believe the greatest part of your infrastructure is human. It is the people who are doing the work. And that's where I want to focus our attention in our closing time here. Infrastructure includes lots of things beyond human. It includes financing. If you don't have operating cash in the checkbook, okay, are you out of business? Does it matter if you have people? No, it doesn't matter if you have people. If you don't have operating cash in the checkbook, you are out of business. Facilities, if you don't, it depends. Now, it's different from ministry to ministry, but land, buildings, rooms, even places to put stuff is part of infrastructure. Equipment, computers, phones, tools, vehicles, processes. Annual planning, budgeting, public relations work, spreading the news about what you're doing, that's all part of your infrastructure. How do you build sustainable ministry infrastructure? You do two things. And if you're looking for an easy and simple answer, there they are, right there. You spend money and you spend time. And if you're not willing to do those two things, I do not have any other answer for you. So you need to go take someone else's workshop and maybe they can help you and have a better answer. I believe you must be willing to invest money and you must be willing to invest time. How do you build human infrastructure? 3 points. Those 3 points are recruitment, training, and retention. Not telling you anything you probably don't know here. Recruitment, training, and retention. What is recruitment? It is securing the right people at the right time. How easy is that to do? I'll just go ahead. We're going to be running a little bit behind here, so we're going to pick up the pace a little bit. You need to know what you're looking for before you need it. Do you do annual planning in your organization? Are you forecasting out ahead what programs are coming online this year? Whoever's really running the core of your organization, whether it's officers or an executive committee, do you really know what you're looking at 3 years from now? Are you talking about that? Are you looking down the road? We use the word pipeline in our organization in a couple of different ways, but one way we use it is a human pipeline too. Okay, the water that comes out of the spigot in the restroom came from somewhere. And most likely that pipe is full of water the whole way from the spigot to a pressure tank, right? Somewhere in this building there's a pressure tank and it's full of water, or it's connected to the public system that's got pressure on it. What's in your human pipeline in your organization? When do you start putting people in this end of the pipeline? They're not useful to you, or they're not visible in the ministry till they come out this end of the pipeline. But are you sticking any in this end of the pipeline way back here? Are you connecting with potential? Just last night, I saw someone from one of these ministries here in the hallway, and we were chatting, and I said, hey, do you know so-and-so? And, no, I'm not sure I do. Maybe I do. And I gave him a name, and I gave him a little bit of information about that person. And I said, that person's got potential. And he's got potential in the area of what you do. And 2 weeks ago, I seen someone else here that does the same thing, and I gave them the name. You need to know this person. This person needs to be on a list somewhere for you, because he's got potential. He's not what you need right now, but I don't think you can pass up getting to know this person just in case. When you recruit, you understand that recruitment is an investment. We're investing in getting to know people, and maybe we're even investing in some people and encouraging them in some area, or pushing them or training them a little bit. And we have to make those investments, or nothing's going to come out this end of the pipe. And investments cost money, or they cost my time, which is more important than a lot of your money, because your time's in shorter supply. I also accept that not all investments work out. That's why you make investments, because they're not all going to pan out, but we're looking for the one that does pan out and yield big results for us down the road. I would like to encourage you as organizations to think about the importance of middle management. I think that is probably the weakest link as a general rule in our organizations. We can find good, high-powered people at the top, and we can find lots of willing people, willing workers down here at this level. We're missing that middle piece. You know, in a factory, he's the foreman or the job boss on a construction crew, that he's not the owner, he's not the project manager, but he can run things. He can get things done. Do you have strong middle management in your organization? In our own organization, AF, we've grown substantially over the last 10 years. I think we've got a good team at the bottom. We've got good staff here, but we're in that transition period where these people at the top need to learn to hand some things down, and you're starting to hand it down. It's like, oh, there's nobody there. Okay? So you either need to train up the ones that are a little further, or you need to pull in. Don't neglect middle management. When you do that, you build in two bad things. You wear out the people who are at the top because they're doing things that they shouldn't be doing anymore. And then when they're doing that, they're doing the rest of their job badly. It's degrading their performance. And all the people down below who are, you know, the salt of the earth doing the Lord's work, they look up and they see these mistakes being made that shouldn't be made because these people are overworked and overtaxed and they're thinking about too many different things at one time. And it discourages their hearts to see that missing piece. So don't let that be you. It's important to get recruitment across the finish line. You're looking for the perfect person. We fell into that in the work we do. We had a certain type of position we're trying to fill. And in our mind, we had such a good person sitting right there, Nevin. Okay, just a perfect fit. We need another Nevin. Okay, well, guess what? There aren't more Nevins. Or there aren't very many, and we'd have to steal one from one of Yun's, and Yun's would feel bad about that. So, you know what we need to do? We need to find a person that's not quite Nevin, but he's got the potential, okay? He's got the capacity. He might need to grow in this area or be trained in this area. But if we spend our life looking for another Nevin, we're not going to fill the position, and we're going to end up in a bad place. A staffer who has a known weakness for which you have a compensating plan is a whole lot better than an empty chair on the day after your Nevin departs and you're looking in that office and the cobwebs are starting to grow. That's not how many ever been and not had that not so good feeling. You waited too long to fill the position. How do you build infrastructure? With training.
Rich, you have a question on recruitment.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the ethics of stealing people from other organizations?
You should not.
I
really can't for sake of time. I'm just gonna have to flip on, but we can talk about that later. That does happen, and you don't help the kingdom by stealing somebody else's people. You'd be better to do this, build some more people.
Because I was raised in a business background where that was so unethical, but I see it happen in ministries all the time. So I thought maybe it's different rules.
The rules are different. Are the rules different? Training. You need to learn to build people. Build your own people. As a ministry, you need to be willing to pay for job-specific training that enables productivity. Not just pay for people to go to school for the sake of going to school, but when it affects your, you know, what you want them to do, they don't know how to do it, but you've got a person with high caliber, you know, the character level is way up here, there is competency there, they are academically able to do this type of task, but they don't have the training that you need for that specific fit. Who in the world should pay for that other than you? Sometimes we make our people learn by mistakes. That cost us more in the long run. We do need to learn to cross-train staff in our organizations because we will have times of shortfall on a staffing point. And Richie does need to be able to step up the plate and do this person's job for 2 weeks. But that's not a long-range solution. We need to be able to have office staffs and administrative staffs where we can cover for each other and pitch hit for each other. But forcing people to work beyond their abilities will cost you more in retention than you will gain in the short-term cost savings. You will burn out people and you will lose them. How do you build human infrastructure? You build human infrastructure by retaining. When you retain, retention is the loss of investment. Okay, if you're going to invest in people in your organization, that's going to cost you. It's going to cost you money, and it's going to cost you time. The least costly and the most effective staff person you can acquire just very well may already be on your payroll. They're already there. They don't have the specific skill sets. They need to grow maybe in leadership. But did you see that coming 3 or 5 years down the road? I need to start growing this person. I need to start stretching their abilities. I need to start adding responsibilities so they learn how to do a little bit of this, and they worked in this department for a little bit, and then I moved them over here intentionally and made them do something different because I want them up here overseeing both of these 5 years from now. Okay, are you thinking ahead like that? Are you paying sustainable compensation? I know many ministries operate on a voluntary service, a VS base, and I'm not speaking against that. That is a treasure that our churches have that we need to hang on to. I'm talking about those key operational people who stick with you over time. They are indispensable to the success of your mission. You need to pay sustainable compensation that they can afford to stay with you and raise their families. You need to offer them relational support. We have stressful jobs in our ministries. There's a lot of responsibility, sometimes resting on a few shoulders, and it goes a long ways if those people know you care about them and you extend that care in small ways. You need to be an organization that is known for building people. And maybe in answer to Teresa's question, you don't want to be known as the organization that's known for stealing people. Okay, are you an organization that becomes known, this takes you time to get it done, but you become known as an organization that built strong people. And many of them stay with you and make your organization strong. And some of them ended up going somewhere else and they made some other organization better than it was. Which do you want to be? When people leave your organization, what's the rule of thumb? When they leave you, are they burnt out or are they ready for what God has next for them in life? What's the experience you have? Infrastructure costs money. Infrastructure is an investment. And if you're not willing to do that, you're not willing to spend time and money on people, then please don't complain when you see other organizations being staffed. They're getting the staff they need, and we don't. And don't start flipping that back on God and questioning God. God is not responsible for the consequences that fall on your organization because of your errors and your failures to act. If you fail to invest in infrastructure, there are going to be consequences, and it's not his fault. God also, at the end, is not responsible to bail you out if you failed to invest in infrastructure that you should have known was needed. That's where we're going to close.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.